Hello and welcome back to The Limitless, the podcast between. It is, or it will be, April Fool's Day when this podcast airs. This is after my 6-week hiatus for Lent, and now I'm back. I haven't changed the name of the podcast. I don't plan to change the format, except perhaps that it will air on Sundays, or I may do it in one part more often to save myself time, but for now I'm even sticking to the usual two-part structure. I'm still in between. I think that actually the logos, the ratio, the line between chaos and order, between God and man, heaven and earth and all that, it seems to be the place to be, the only place to be. So that's kind of liminal. That is the threshold that we both never cross and at the same time are forever crossing back and forth over. Maybe we exist on both sides. Well, I guess we do. So I'm sticking with the title. Things have changed in this time I've been away. I'm sure they will show in subtle ways or not so subtle as we proceed. And this week I'm talking to Gregory Desolate. By the way,
I'm 68.
You know, the reason I ask, I mean, besides just general curiosity, is that as I re-embark on this podcast, one of the things I wanted to include is an attempt to reinstate the idea of wisdom of the elders, a respect for, you know, what older people have to say. And I figured I'd have the cutoff point at 65, you know. So you make the grade there. You get to be one of the elders that I introduce the wayward youth to.
Okay, that's great. Yeah, I think that's a good notion. Yeah. Respect for the elders. There's not much of that going around, I would say.
No, it's pretty much dead in the water, I'd say.
Well, you certainly had some of that going for you in your liking for Pauline Kael. Isn't she quite a bit older?
She was, and it's actually been a phenomenon in my life that the sort of public figures or famous celebrities or whatever, I mean, that's a kind of modern term, but the people that I've admired that have achieved some sort of social status, the only ones that I've managed to really connect to have been old. They've invariably, like, it was Kenneth Grant, the occultist, there was Pauline Kael, there was Paul Bowles, there was William Burroughs just before he died. They've always been very old, which I think is some significance in that, perhaps because they're no longer struggling to, you know, to achieve, and they're more open to just dialoguing. I mean, that's just a guess, but maybe it's something else.
Yeah.
But anyway, that was just by way of intro. I just picked up your book for literally 5 minutes ago just to refresh, and by which I mean Our Faith in Evil.
Oh, yeah.
And I had the thought that it's the place to start, evil, because we have a shared preoccupation, I'd say. I wonder who doesn't really have a preoccupation with evil, really. I mean, one way or another. It's hard not to be preoccupied by it, right? So but one thing occurred to me when I was looking over what you said, what you wrote there about, for example, that the the desire to expunge evil itself can be seen as an evil. He talked about the irony of Hitler being seen as an archetypal evil figure when what motivated Hitler was this desire to eradicate evil. It struck me that there's something inherently paradoxical around evil, the idea of evil, and that also applies to religion, religious doctrine, that the most central paradox to at least Christianity, and at least for me, is in this concept of evil. Evil existing in a world that, or in a reality that everything belongs to God, right? So that there's this inherent paradox, and it seems that you're circling around that in your work as well, because you're mm-hmm. trying to reevaluate evil as something that is a misperception of nature, of the natural order of things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that sounds exactly right. I was raised Roman Catholic. And I was raised in a fairly strict family regarding that, and it just I can remember back to my days when getting catechism lessons, and just the way the whole thing built up from a child's point of view, where, for example, in the first grade, you see a crucifix of Christ up above the blackboard, and when I look back on it, it always struck me as kind of odd that in the first grade you would have this picture front and center brought to your attention of a crucified figure on a cross, which, when you think about it, would be pretty traumatic for kids that age to just be confronting, let alone having it kind of pushed in their faces. And I got to thinking about all of that as I got older and thinking, wow, there's just something very twisted about all of this. And a good part of that is how you're made to feel concerning the nature of the world and the fact that you are made aware that there is evil and that there's something called Satan or the devil and all of this stuff. And from a kind of what I would call metaphysical point of view, you're given this very polarized image of the world, and as a child, it's very, very difficult to, I think, evaluate that properly when you just get indoctrinated in it. And so, as I got older, looking back on it, I just thought the whole thing was more and more twisted, and so the more I thought about it, the more I wanted to write about it. And Our Faith in Evil is really a book that kind of goes beyond the religious concept, although it does, I do mention religion in it and kind of put up a critique of religion and the metaphysical foundation of so many religions and the good-evil dichotomy. But I trace it even deeper to like the metaphysical level, where basically it's an idea of how do we as human beings conceptualize dichotomies in general, ugly or beautiful or black and white or whatever the dichotomy might be. It seems like to me there's a very important aspect of in terms of how it's structured, because you can think of it as kind of a zero-sum game where one side is completely contaminated and worthy of elimination, and the other side is perfectly good, and that's what's to be endorsed and supported. And that very polarized orientation to dichotomies, I think, gets transferred into how we look at conflict. And so any conflict that comes up, we don't tend to make it complicated. We tend to make it simple, like one side is right and the other side is wrong, and that's just the way it is. And I know that that's a bit of an oversimplification, but I think all too often it's frighteningly accurate in how people tend to view conflict and lay this kind of like template over daily conflicts that are really very complex. And so then I began thinking about that in connection with films and dramatic plots, and seeing that basic metaphysical orientation is carried out in a lot of movie plots as well.
Right.
So it's not just religion, but it's like I think everywhere you look in a lot of cultures, not just Western cultures, you see it also in Eastern cultures. So,
right. Well, that would speak to how movies have this similarity to myths and being collective dreams in being ways that we attempt to work out these polarities in our existence that we then somehow inadvertently or inevitably convert into dichotomies, as you say, to simplify them. And it seems that, I mean, what you're looking at in the book is how and why it doesn't work, it seems, like both dramatically and on a larger scale, this polarization. And what you're describing there, in simple terms, is like totalitarianism, this idea that there's a good, and in order for it to be in the position it needs to be in, as in all pervasive, we have to eradicate an evil. And yet again, another ironic paradox: totalitarianism is viewed as evil by our you're right. So once again, we've got this thing that becomes the thing that it tries to eradicate via the attempt to eradicate it. And it was occurring to me when you brought up the image of Christ on the cross, and I've never thought this before, but, well, I mean, the obvious thing about Christ is that the evil is rendered in some way much worse by the fact that it's happening to a good person. That he's purely innocent, and yet the worst things happen to him, so that lets us know how vulnerable we are to this apparent evil. And yet that's the meaning of the Christ myth, is that Christ is framed, as it were, on the cross. So Christ is given, his life is given meaning, and his goodness is made apparent by being put in a context of evil. Which I'd never had that thought before, but it's very, seems very clear now that I'm having it.
Yeah, I think that that reminds me of what I wrote about The Passion of the Christ, Mel Gibson's film, and the effect that it had on me. And it just seemed like in that film, he does take and exaggerate to the extremes the innocence of Christ and the brutality and the evil of the persecutors.
Right.
And he does that. I mean, the effects of that on people, on audiences, I think, is to just increase and build an enormous sense of outrage. You know, it's like nothing could be more out of joint than somebody being persecuted who doesn't deserve it.
Right.
So it inflames the passions and brings people to the boiling point. And it seems that Gibson really intended to try to, you know, exacerbate that and build it up. And yet there is this notion, yeah, that it's all done for the good of humanity, and that Christ sacrificed himself. And one of the points I make in that is that the degree to which Christ must suffer and feel pain is in proportion to the degree of sinfulness in human nature. So the reason Christ must suffer so deeply to sacrifice or for himself or redeem human nature is because human nature is so depraved, as I think Gibson tries to illustrate when he's showing the Romans whipping Christ. And so that then builds a picture of human nature as being so depraved that we start off feeling badly about ourselves, and then we are very, very thankful to Christ for having repaired that and made it possible for us to be cleansed. And the problem with that is that why start out with a picture of human being and human nature as being so depraved? And that's what has always puzzled me. How did we get there?
Because it's not consistent with scripture either. Like, man is made in God's image, Christ is half human. So, if humanity was that depraved, then it wouldn't speak very well for Christ either.
I mean, the more you look at it, the more it just starts to not make much sense. And so that's troubling. And I think that human nature is complicated. Certainly human beings are not, innocent saints. We've all had our experiences, I'm sure, with and we scratch our heads and think, God, is sometimes we wonder, is humanity even worth saving? But I think the complexities of the thing, I mean, you can find it all the way through nature. I mean, you look at the animal kingdom and you see, one animal feeds off of another. And if you've ever watched crocodiles feed at a watering hole, you tend to get a picture of the brutality and the ugliness of nature. Whereas a lot of times we're shown images of it where, you see fuzzy little animals and look real cute and birds singing in trees, but it's not all beautiful. So nature, it's not just human beings, but it's nature itself that's complicated, and we are a part of that. But I don't think that it makes a lot of sense to even, and a lot of people do this, I think Christians especially, they tend to demonize nature itself, as somehow flawed and as contaminated by evil, which was not part of God's intention, but which evolved that way.
Well, that's kind of a Gnostic view, isn't it, then, at that point?
The Gnostic view of a very radical, polarized good and evil metaphysical system in the cosmos. And even when you start thinking about that, it starts not to make very much sense, because if you think, well, and this is just the classic question, how does evil come into the world? If God created the world and God is perfectly good, how did it get here in the first place? And of course, that has been a stumper for theologians for centuries. And the answer is usually that, well, God gave human beings free will, and of their free will, they can be influenced to commit evil. And because God in his goodness didn't want to make us like machines and be perfect in his image, and because we have free will, then we're capable of being evil. Well, even that, like, how did the capacity for choosing evil even get in the universe? It's just, you can keep going further and further with that into a regress where it has no real answer and makes no real sense. And as a result, the metaphysical point of view that I try to explain and illustrate in the book is one in which you have a dichotomy at the very origin, and both sides of the dichotomy are not good and evil, but both sides are mixtures of both good and evil, or mixtures of whatever, and that they are balanced. They're even. It's like yin and yang. Neither yin nor yang is good or evil in itself. They are different forces, and the playing out of those forces creates situations that are sometimes ugly and sometimes beautiful. But neither side is to be painted as purely and elementally evil. So I think it's a much better metaphysical, and it makes a lot more sense when you think, well, evil doesn't come into the world. Evil is something that human beings project onto the world and create, in a sense, which is not to say that the world is without tragedy, but that the world is not, you know, a metaphysical system in which there is some ultimate evil out there that needs to be combated. So I carry that out in the notion of the tragic drama as being a better, more ennobling kind of conflict or way to look at conflict. So does that square with what you had gotten out of it when you were reading it?
Well, I think so. I mean, you read what I wrote about it, so I certainly found a lot to resonate with. And but it's a question that I could say I've been wrestling with my entire adult life. And you know, I was raised by liberals, and that meant that I was indoctrinated with atheism, first of all, and secondly with a disbelief in evil. And while I rejected the atheism very early on, I've held on to that sense that evil is a concept that doesn't represent reality sufficiently for me to like to use it or to rely on it. Putting that in a very long-winded way, but it is kind of equivocal. I mean, I as you've read, even the stuff you have read, and you haven't read the darkest stuff, I do investigate the kinds of things going on in the world that could be construed as evil, like child sexual abuse, you know, deliberate sadistic kind of child sexual abuse and mind control programs and, you know, all kinds of horrors. But anyway, I still haven't committed to the idea of evil, even though I can see that these acts are absolutely willfully destructive. And then more recently, I've been orienting myself, well, I found myself becoming more oriented towards a religious point of view. And so I've been looking at it again or in with new eyes. And so I'm not quite sure where I stand, but it's very interesting to talk to you about at this point, because you have the religious background. And so all kinds of thoughts are firing off now. So it's hard to know which one to pick, but one that keeps coming back to the front of my mind is about Christ and the distinction you make between melodrama and tragedy. And I think we'd have to say that the gospel is certainly not a melodrama, even if some Christians try and interpret it that way in terms of, you know, Christ battling Satan. There isn't really much of that in there, I suppose, Revelation. But anyway, so if that makes it a tragedy, in some sense, then, and bringing it back to this notion that evil is a misapprehension of something that's inherent within creation and in all of us, then do you see Christ, at least from your critical perspective, as opposed to your Catholic or lapsed Catholic one, as a tragic hero in some way who brought about his own catastrophe?
That's a really good point, a really good question. I would say there's two answers to it. One is that, and it's kind of like not that it's a strict analogy, but it's similar with Plato. But with Christ in the New Testament, I think there is a sense in which it has been, that whole story has been transformed into a melodrama by institutionalized versions of Christianity. But when, you know, I've spoken with and been influenced by a couple of Jesuit priests who showed me a way of reading and understanding the New Testament, especially the Gospel of Matthew, in a very different, in what could be described as more of a tragic drama perspective, where the whole metaphysical platform or grounding of it is much more complex than the simplistic melodramatic plot structure. Mm-hmm. And in fact, these two Jesuits were drawing parallels with certain Eastern traditions like Taoism and Zen Buddhism with the Gospel of Matthew. And I had never been able to see that. It was like a real revelation for me to read it in that way and to see that it was possible to read it in that way. And so I think you're right in saying that the story of Christ can be viewed as a tragedy. It's something that I think it's more difficult to read it that way if you see Christ as a person who is an innocent man who brings a kind of, who through perhaps no real fault of his own, except perhaps his own goodness, brings a kind of catastrophe upon himself. That plot structure is one I think Aristotle would find a little bit gruesome rather than tragic. But still, I think there are ways of even reading it differently than that, so that you begin to see Christ as a figure who is causing people to think in very different ways, you know, causing them to get out of the strict polarizations. You know, from Christ's point of view, everyone is to be treated equally, and conflicts are not automatically clear. You have a situation where Christ is getting people to open their eyes and look at people beyond their hierarchical positions in society, treating each other more as human beings. And those are the kinds of things about Christ that you begin to have a tremendous amount of respect for.
And to look at him, look at themselves first, right? There's at least two cases where he's saying, if you're going to judge, start with yourself.
Mm-hmm.
So that seemed to be very key to, and that maybe that's even a parallel for the tragic structure versus the melodramatic structure.
Mm-hmm.
As in looking within. The hero who looks within to find the devil within himself rather than who looks without to find an oppositional force to, you know, oppose and therefore strengthen his own ego identity.
Right. Yeah, when your perspective begins to allow that kind of inner glance, then the conflict gets more complicated. And you see that there's a part of your enemy in yourself. You know, you're not completely of a different substance, let's say, than your enemy. And when you can have some kind of a bridging of the gulf like that, then I think you start getting into tragic ways of looking at conflict. And conflict resolution. And I just think all of that is such a more productive way of viewing it. And personally, when I watch movies that portray conflict in that way, I just have a much stronger reaction to it. I mean, I find it powerfully emotional and compelling, more so than the melodramatic stuff that we see so often.
Thank you.
Well, before we get to movies, because I know we're going to get there, let's stay on the Christ thing a moment longer and look at what the resurrection means in this context, because tragedy is something that ends badly, and Christ's story only ends badly if we end it at the crucifixion and not at the resurrection. So perhaps there's something in there, and that there is tragedy is a means to some sort of higher resolution. So it only appears tragic from the point of view of the sort of diabolical ego that gets exposed by that inward glance, and maybe even dissolved or crucified by it. But then on the other side of that process, there's something else.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's another good point in that. And this surprised me when I first learned it, when I was rereading Aristotle's Poetics. I hit upon the passage, and I don't know the exact reference citation for it, but I know it's in there somewhere, where he says that tragedy doesn't have to end with the death of the hero, or in that kind of violent, unhappy way. You could have a very profound tragic drama, and yet things can still turn out relatively well at the end. It's from Aristotle's point of view, what a tragedy is not necessarily marked by an unhappy or violent or destructive ending, although quite often it is. But the tragedy that has a happier ending is one in which the characters are brought into very destructive actions, but are somehow saved from either destroying themselves or destroying someone else before it's too late. And this could be an interpretation of, let's say, Christ's death and redemption as a tragic drama, even though he is redeemed and risen from the dead at the end. Still would possibly qualify it as tragic in the senses that we're talking about, and how Christ teaches a new way of looking at conflict, and his resurrection being the path forward, which is a brighter path because of the way in which we human beings can improve through this knowledge of how to treat other human beings and how to treat ourselves.
Mm. Right, and how the two feed into each other.
Yeah.
Yeah. You're familiar with Girard?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
'Cause, I mean, the whole notion of the scapegoat here, how he looks at the Gospels as exposing the scapegoat mechanism, and thereby potentially dissolving it, or showing how it can be dissolved through turning the other cheek and not resisting evil, and all of that, and Christ's willing surrender to evil. That seems to all speak to what we're talking about, which is like, 'cause scapegoating is when we project our own distress onto another and then destroy or cast out the other and think we've actually solved something, right? Which it can solve it for the community, as Girard writes, but for the individual it seems that could never work, because the very fact that you're able to project this distress or this distortion out onto something in order to scapegoat it means that it's going to still be in you,
mm-hmm.
at the end of the process. So it's going to keep, you're going to have to keep finding new scapegoats.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the melodramatic structure, essentially, isn't it? It always depends on a scapegoat, mm-hmm. villain.
Yeah, and that's another very important issue. And there's a parallel. You probably haven't read much of a fellow by the name of Kenneth Burke.
A little bit, because he talked with Girard, and they sort of compared theories.
Yeah, there are some similarities between Burke and Girard on the notion of scapegoating. And one of the parallels that I found interesting was that Burke recognizes the scapegoating thing. He calls it the scapegoating mechanism. And he sees it as, kind of like Girard, as fundamental in human relations, as something almost that we can't get rid of, and that all we can do is figure out coping mechanisms to reduce the ultimately destructive effects of it. And one of the ways that Burke recommends that we do this is by doing scapegoating through literature or through words or by working it out in a virtual world instead of in the real world. So in that sense, he might look at melodramatic entertainments as kind of from a cathartic point of view, as possibly being beneficial in that it is a way of working this out so that we're not actually engaged in actual victimage, but we're doing symbolic victimage. And part of the tracings of that, as you're saying, can often go into the self, where we are projecting outward some aspect of the self that we would like to disown or eliminate. And my eventual thoughts about all of that were that, well, just as I don't believe the good-evil paradigm is a very good way of looking at the external world or looking at nature or looking at the cosmos, neither do I think it's a good way of picturing the self or the division within the self. I don't think there is a part of the self that is totally evil or, you know, worthy of elimination any more than there is any part of the world. If whatever comes into the world is part of nature, then in some sense it's natural and it's supposed to be there. And to portray it as something that is ultimately worthy of elimination, I think, is to be mistaken, in that nature herself has not viewed it that way. So there must be, I think, a way of formulating it so that we understand that what is natural to nature is dichotomies, tensions, conflicts, differences, because as deconstructionists like to say, difference is the generating principle. Without difference, we don't have anything. So that difference, I think, we do when we find that in ourselves, we don't need necessarily to picture that or portray it as something worthy of elimination. And so if we can improve the way in which we are imagining or thinking of the essence of the self, and the division within the self, if we can improve that model and eliminate the polarity, the stark polarity in it, then I think we also do something good for human relations and for the relationship of one person to another, as well as one person's relationship to him or herself. Is that making sense?
Yeah, it is. It's sparking up a whole bunch more thoughts. Around specifically around the ego, because the first thought I had when you said, "Oh well, you can't transpose the good evil thing to internally either, and say there's something to get rid of or eliminate." My first thought was, "What about the ego?" You know, because I've been trying to get rid of my ego for several decades now, and that. Yeah. But then I realized that actually one of the insights I've had through trying and failing with that struggle is that. I think really it's the ego that sees itself as something to eliminate in a weird way. Like that's a kind of egoic perspective that that the ego is something bad that needs to be eliminated, as opposed to the perspective of the self. I'm using Jungian terms now. I'm not really that fond of Jung, but anyway, in terms of something that is beyond the ego that is still us, I don't think it sees it that way at all. And I think that it's not about eliminating something, but that something that is natural at a certain point in our development becomes unnatural after a given point, but that sometimes it still remains in place, and that there's a sort of process that happens, and hopefully I can bring this back to movies, but where we if we start to see the way in which we have sort of got trapped in a distorted view of reality, let's say, if we start to see that and also the mechanism that's trapped us, it starts coming undone naturally. Because if we're starting to see the thing through which we perceive or misperceive reality, then we're starting to see the ways in which we misperceive reality. And so then the very thing that keeps telling us this is how to perceive reality loses its persuasive power. And I think that I was having this thought earlier, too, we weren't really talking about movies, but melodrama and tragedy, that maybe, and I don't know if you've considered this, but maybe, because I do like good evil movies, some of them. If they're done well, I still respond to that. And maybe that a really good melodrama can serve the purpose of, I don't know about tragedy, but in a sense, the purpose of seeing beyond good and evil, because by the sheer fact that it's a movie. So we see, and I was going to say also that the good evil movies that I like, or that work, in my view, they do create sympathy for the villain. They don't demonize the villain, so that if he, when he does get destroyed, you feel for him. Like Blue Velvet would be a very obvious example. Like I felt a lot of love for Frank Booth. I didn't feel sad when he died. It didn't go to that extent. I felt sad for him throughout, and then I felt relieved when he died, partly because his suffering was over, I think.
Which character is that?
The Dennis Hopper character, that Frank Booth, that. Yeah, torments Jeffrey in Blue Velvet.
Okay, right.
So yeah, anyway, I mean, that's a personal example, and in many ways, Blue Velvet, I would say, isn't melodrama. I'd say it does transcend that for sure. But even with a simpler movie, there is a tendency, if it's skillfully done, that they make the villain sympathetic, right? They make him certainly charismatic. That's kind of a side point. My main point was that maybe the act of watching a movie, getting engrossed in the story, identifying with the hero, sort of hating the villain while loving him also, love, hate, and feeling satisfaction at his destruction, it is cathartic in some, I would say, fairly superficial way, but it could be illuminating also, because we have the experience of falling under the spell of this melodrama. And so we get to see a sort of process in ourselves where we create these melodramas, but they're just movies that we're playing in our head.
I think you're really on to something there. And to be honest with you, it's something that I have struggled with because there are forms of melodrama that I have had the reaction to that you're describing. And I think they are more complicated forms of melodrama. And one way I have tried to talk about that is to call it, I think I use the term reflexive melodrama, where what happens is that the conflict is set up in a highly polarized way, where the audience is brought to kind of through the eyes of, let's say, one of the protagonists is brought to see the conflict in a very polarized way as being, one side totally good, the other side totally evil. And then in the course of the drama, the audience and the interactions, the events and the characters lead the audience to see that, well, maybe that this isn't quite as polarized as we thought. Maybe there's some reason to have sympathy for this villain. Maybe the villain has his or her own motives or reasons for what they're doing. And you begin to, and it re starts to reverse to where you're thinking the audience is now puzzled about, well, which side of this drama should I be on? And at the end, we are even brought to a certain awareness that maybe the person we thought was the hero, as in Moby Dick, Ahab, is not really the hero after all, but some kind of a tormented, twisted person. And then you as an audience member, you go away from that, you know, thinking, well, what have I just witnessed here, and how do I make sense of it? And that form of melodrama, I think, is extremely powerful and awakening. And I think it does, in my opinion, edge more in the direction of tragic drama, because it does begin to get you to see both sides of a conflict, even if at the end of the day you come out more on one side than the other. At least you are giving the villain his due, so to speak, and understanding that you know, things are not as simple as we originally thought.
Can you think of any examples of that?
Well, you know, Moby Dick was one. I think Les Miserables is another. A good example of that is Les Miserables. I think it has some very, you know, the heroes and villains there. The villain, especially at the end, you are brought to recognize that, and through the, I'm forgetting the characters' names now. See, Valjean and the other characters I'm forgetting, but you're brought at the end to see the villain from the protagonist's point of view, from the hero's point of view, and the hero doesn't hate the villain, and in a sense lets him off the hook at the end. And this this act is, I think, for many audiences dumbfounding. You know, it's like the whole process of the drama, you're like cheering for this villain to get what's coming to him, but slowly toward the end you realize that this villain is another tortured human being who is kind of doing what he's doing out of a very mistaken view of reality, and you just begin to have sympathy for him. And so it can be very surprising and I think disturbing for audiences, and that's one reason I think Les Miserables continues to be a drama that has legs. You know, it's a classic, and it will continue to be a classic, like Moby Dick.
So you're referring to the stage performance as well as the book, then?
Yeah.
Because I haven't read the book or seen the play, so I'm entirely ignorant of this, but it's very interesting. I was imagining also, I mean, if there were a movie that successfully did this reversal, and maybe there is, but I don't know, I think I would know about it. It seems like it would be a really compelling thing to do that flip over. Now I'm thinking of Fight Club, but that didn't exactly do that. It did do a flip over, so you didn't know up from down. And also The Usual Suspects did that twist at the end, and you didn't really even know who anyone was. But
yeah,
that's not specifically what you're talking about, where there's a gradual reversal of the poles, and what we thought was the hero becomes the villain, and vice versa. It seems like that would be an amazingly compelling experience if it was done well.
Yeah, and another movie that I think is a lot like that too is a Western called Red River. Don't know if you've ever seen that.
Yeah. Yeah, it was the only movie in your book that you really raved about that I also really liked.
Yeah, and I think that's a unusual, because it's not the way a drama plays out normally in the Western genre. it stands out a little, but. Yeah, I think there are examples of, you know, what I would think of as more classical tragic drama, but also this kind of like reflexive melodrama in more let's say more modern productions. But it's
so. What does the reflexive mean here in this context exactly?
Well, the way I'm trying to use that term, it means that. When the audience is led to project the conflict in a very polarized way, as for one particular side of the conflict being the heroic side and the other being the villain side. And then as the audience is brought to reflexively look at that, that structuring of the conflict, so that they're not just doing it, but they're looking at the structure, and the structure is actually changing in front of their eyes.
Right.
So that you get this, you're forced to confront the way in which you're structuring the conflict.
Right.
And you're forced to alter that in a certain way. And so that's where I see that the conflict is like turned back upon itself in a way. Mm. So that, to be honest, I was never totally happy with the word reflexive melodrama, but I couldn't think of anything better at the time, so I went ahead and used it.
Oh, no, it's a really good word, whether it's the right one for this, I think but it's very interesting because it has various different meanings, which is why I asked. Just wanted to interject also that the way you describe it there really does describe Fight Club, because in that movie he's apparently having a conflict with some character, and then at a certain point you realize that he's the only one there and it's all internal. So, but anyway, but back to reflexive, it has at least three meanings. One is a reflection, as in a mirror. The other is to reflect, which is to contemplate. And then the third is a reflex action, as in when we're struck and, you know, our body just naturally reacts in that way. So it seems like a very rich term in the context we're talking about of projection and scapegoating and looking inward and all these different things. It seems as though that word is really charged with meaning here. Well, and I mean, to bring it to specifics, a movie that I love that you don't like, I'm in the majority, you're in the minority, The Godfather. I would say that's a very reflective movie, just in an ordinary sense, as in there's a lot to reflect on, and the characters are reflecting on the main character, Corleone. He's doing a lot of reflecting. I'd also say it was a tragedy in some sense, at least in the sense that he starts out as a seemingly good character, and his ambition, you know, like Macbeth, he ends up as really an evil character. I'd also say it certainly doesn't meet the requirements of melodrama, because there's no good evil conflict. It's evil versus evil, really. Which I think is an interesting idea in itself. I had a friend once who said that. He said, you know, there aren't enough movies that are good versus good and evil versus evil. He was talking about Bram Stoker's Dracula, which he felt was a case of good versus good. It seems to me that if you had a character populated by all good people, well, you wouldn't have much of a story. And that most of the movies and TV shows, or many of them, let's say, and including ones that you single out for dislike or negative criticism, are essentially evil versus evil, like Boardwalk Empire. But all these characters are basically immersed in one level of vice or another, and they're just fighting for the piece of the pie. And you could say about The Godfather at a higher level, essentially, besides sort of semi-innocent victims like Michael's wife, or his sister, there aren't, both women, there aren't really any good characters in it, in a sense of, you know, by judging by their fruit, by their actions, there aren't really any characters who are doing any good or really trying to, opposing the evil of the mafia that's unfolding. So then what all that leaves is this internal struggle of one character, who I would say is a stand-in for us, who is unable to extricate himself from this world of kind of just relentless corruption and vice. And to me that represents the human experience quite closely, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
Not literally, in terms of most of us don't grow up in the mafia, but most of us grow up in families where there's all kinds of secrets and toxic, you know, behaviors, and we try to extricate ourselves from them, but mostly don't succeed. And so yeah, I mean wondering if that as a specific example, maybe we could talk around the ways in which that doesn't meet your criteria, and why not.
Yeah, well, I think you put your finger on, you know, if my thinking has some weak areas, I think that film in particular is one in which, you know, a good case could be made for at least refuting the way in which I've categorized that film, you know, by saying that, well, okay, I don't like this film, because of the way it's structured. And I do think, you know, a lot of these films are arguable. I wouldn't want to give the impression, you know, even in the case of Taxi Driver, and we can touch on that too a little bit later. But I don't want to give the impression that I think these are, you know, like really clear-cut distinctions. What I'm trying to do is draw some general patterns. And in the case of The Godfather, to defend what I have said about it, and the reasons why I didn't think it was great drama, I would trace some of my reasoning back to some thinking that comes from Aristotle, where he's talking about the structures of different dramas, and he's saying that, well, okay, when you have a drama where you have a relatively normal person who descends into corruption and lower levels of corruption, that this is not, he calls it, I believe, an odious drama. You know, it's not something that is to be thought of in terms of the power and the enlightening kind of experience you can get from what he categorizes as tragic drama. Mm. Now, in justifying that, I would say that, well, one of the things that I look at when I'm trying to, let's say, fit films into my category system, which of course is often a cookie cutter kind of thing to do, but I do it anyway because sometimes it gives me insights. But in the case of The Godfather, I think that the thing that I look for is what I call contrapuntal characters. If you have an anti-hero or someone who starts out kind of neutral and ascends into corruption, as we see in The Godfather, if you don't have adequate contrapuntal characters that basically provide a path for the audience to follow to form kind of a critique of what the anti-hero is doing, then you run the risk of members of the audience who may not be as quick on the uptake as others, you run the risk of heroizing the anti-hero and making it appear as though that everything that this person is doing is somehow to be thought of as admirable. And I realize, you know, the quick response to that would be in the case of The Godfather that certainly, there are things you can point to where this person is not being heroized, but he is being exposed as a real scoundrel as things develop. But I don't think that, at least my reaction and to the film was one where I didn't feel there was enough. It was just too much of, let's say, a voyeuristic activity of looking into the lives of what I would call relatively petty and dark criminals who are battling over money and thing, you know, the conflicts that they are about and the things that they are doing are not engaged in, you know, noble things, but just engaged in power and money. And so I looked at it as a kind of voyeuristic activity of just probing into the violence and the power struggles and the conflicts in a kind of sensationalistic way. And, you know, to be honest, that may not be the best way to look at the film.
Did you feel any? I'm thinking particularly the second one when things really go bad, and I leave the third one out as if it didn't even exist, even though ironically that was when Coppola tried to redeem his hero. So potentially he could have, if he'd done it right, he could have maybe taken the whole thing out the other side to a new level. But anyway, he didn't. But the second one, is really, it leaves at the end. Michael is a hollow shell of a human being. And did you not feel any sense of pathos? Did you not feel empathy on behalf of Michael?
Yeah, I would have to say I did. I mean, I think it's partly to the skill in selecting character and playing that role. You know, Al Pacino. He's a person with whom I think there's just something about him that makes it easier for audiences to identify with him, even when he is playing a fairly ugly person. Just some people have that quality, and I think he does what you're suggesting. You know, even when someone is reacting the way I am, he still pulls you in, and he makes you feel some sympathy because you tend to see some good in him, or at least the potential for good. And it's almost like you're pulling for him, you know, like, God, you know, can you reach into that part of yourself and draw this out, you know? And then his failure to do it just leaves you like, oh my God. And so I think in acting sometimes, you have to give some credit in that direction. And so in that sense, I have to concede your point that, you know, that film and its story is one that's more on the borderline between tragic drama and melodrama, or at least a drama of the type that Aristotle is wanting to describe as odious. It's more on the edge, and it can't really be easily categorized either way. And I think plus the fact that the whole organized crime story in the United States is a compelling story for many Americans because it's so much a part of our history that, you know, you have to, I think, look at it almost as not quite a documentary, but just to get a notion going in that direction. Like it's part of our history, even if it's fictionalized or dramatized in a certain way. You know that things like this actually did take place. And in that sense, it's like, okay, America, take a look at yourself and some of the people that you have created and some of the things they have done. And that in itself is a tragic story. So, yeah, I think at the end of the day, someone could beat me up pretty badly on how I have done with that film. And so I, but I did do it with, I think I put it out there because I was interested to see, I think, how many people would agree with me.
Did you find any?
Well, oddly enough, you know, I haven't really found anyone who has come out and kind of like you have, you know, pointed to that and said, hey, Greg, what's going on here? No one has done that, but no one has come out to say much of anything about what I've said about that film at all. I've had lots of reactions on some of the other reviews that I have given. I've gotten some very with respect to especially Screens of Blood and some of the things that I say in there about some of the movies, and Boardwalk Empire is an example. I've had some vehement responses from people on that who just think that I'm completely out to lunch. And I have had some people who have strongly agreed with me, but no one has really come forward to say anything directly about what I've said about The Godfather, which is a little bit disappointing, but I like the fact that you have.
Yeah, and of course I'm not interested in beating you up about it. I think, I mean, disagreement is always an opportunity for going deeper into things, and because so many of the points you make in more general philosophical and psychological, whatever you would call it, way when you're writing from a wider perspective, they're very compelling. So it's easy for me to see that you're somebody who has a lot of insight. And as you know, my experience was then, after having kind of recognized that, your level of insight, to then having developed respect for your judgment, to then find that your judgment was often a travesty to my own sensibility, was a very compelling challenge. As you know, that's what inspired me to write my own response in the first place, was that sort of internal tension that creates. And I am somebody who questions everything that I believe, at least within reason. I think one can go too far with that, as with everything. I don't question the reality of biological sex, unlike many people. But anyway, as far as my tastes and preferences, I certainly do do that. And so it's good to start, you know, to end up at a sacred cow. Taxi Driver was the obvious case that I focused on. But The Godfather, I mean, you didn't write about it as much. And so now we're like, I mean, it's certainly, there are certain things that I can entertain about The Godfather that I haven't entertained before, that might actually support your case.
Certainly the direction that Coppola goes with it, with the other two sequels, is somewhat confirms my fears about the direction that that could be taken with that. You know, it's just like it becomes you just sort of wallowing in the violence and the craziness of it all by the end. And so I'm with you on the third movie that it was disappointing. But
sorry, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to add that I think the reason I didn't say a whole lot about the first film was that I think I was not as sure about my judgment of that film, and so I didn't. I just kind of put some thoughts out there and showed where I tended to categorize it, and kind of moved on to to see what reactions I would get.
Right. Well, I mean it. It sort of testified to your overall position, I think, and bringing it back to Aristotle, because I think, he was no lightweight, and I'm sure he knew what he was talking about when he was writing about this, what you've described as the odious drama that a character just descends deeper and deeper into corruption, and I can see how there might be something, how can I say, I'm not finding the word, but...
disturbing?
No, not this disturbing, because I think art should always be disturbing, and I certainly don't think it needs to be life-affirming, but I do think that it needs to be in some sense uplifting, or that it allows us to... find our way through to the other side. So bringing it back to this possibility that tragedy can still be tragedy and yet lead to some sort of greater outcome. Well, that resonates for me a lot. But then, of course, if we're going to make a criticism of tragedy that it doesn't do that, then the whole of Shakespeare would come under that rubric. So what would Aristotle have said about Shakespeare, do you think? Like the darkest ones were. I mean, Macbeth, doesn't he just go from corruption to corruption?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I haven't written hardly anything about Shakespeare. And one of the reasons is that I think that, well, Shakespeare is so honored and glorified, and for the most part, rightly so. But I do think Shakespeare's tragedies do not fall generally into the category of a Greek tragic drama and into the structure of a good Greek tragic drama. His tragedies, I think, are a little melodramatic. And yet, you know, I hesitate to really put them in that category either. And so... I haven't confronted Shakespeare because I've been waiting for an inspiration. Hamlet, I think, is something that I could make a case for. It would be a tough case to make it into more of a melodrama. But it could also be made a case for it in terms of tragic drama. And so I wanted to get an insight, some greater clarity on how to approach Shakespeare from the perspectives that I've been developing before I came out and said something in writing about them and took on some kind of a position. But just in general, the way I feel right now is that I do have a lot of respect for Shakespeare and the beauty of his work. But I do tend to respect more most of the Greek tragic drama structures, especially Sophocles, Aeschylus, not quite as much Euripides, but I have a little bit more respect for, because I think I feel I understand the Greek tragic structure a little bit better than what's going on with Shakespeare. So that's the best I can say about that.
Thank you.
the end of first part of my conversation with Greg Desolate. That's Desolate, not Desolate. What a great name. You can find Greg's website in the show notes. Part two of our conversation will be up next Wednesday. I'd like to thank Michael M. for bankrolling this week's podcast. I'd also like to let my listeners know that Prisoner of Infinity, UFO, Social Engineering, and the Psychology of Fragmentation is released today. That's April 1st. And you can find it on Amazon, various different, depending where you are. I'll be doing a series of YouTube videos about the material there, but I encourage people to buy that book now and see if we can get it up the charts and draw a little attention to it. I know that many of my listeners, readers, are familiar with the material, but if you like to support me, then buying the book would be a great way to do so. This is Jason Horsley at The Liminalist, the podcast between.
So much heaven and hell and vice versa, it's hard to make a decision. There's so much loving and hate and vice versa, it's hard to speak with precision. Should I hold you? Should I kick you? Should I kiss you? Should I spit on you? There's so much heaven and hell and vice versa, it's hard to make a decision. Truth and a lie and vice versa, it's easy to lose the direction. There's so much fiction in fact and vice versa, it don't stand up to inspection. Should I hold you? Should I kick you? Should I kiss you?
Should I spit on you?
There's so much truth and a lie and vice versa, it's easy to lose the direction. Should I kick you? Should I kiss you?
Should I...